This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book today is titled Recovery from Anger Addiction: How I Recovered from Rage by Resolving My Lifetime of Losses and Pain. And joining me from Arizona in the United States of America is author Verrill V. Fosnight. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
This is an extensive read. I would say extensive only from the standpoint that there are over 326 pages of your telling your story. There must have been a story behind the story. Why did this book get written?
Well, I wrote it to give back to the recovery community in gratitude for my own recovery from my own addictions. And nobody had ever... When I realized that anger was an addiction for me, I thought maybe it was for everyone, and I would try to add that to the literature of recovery books.
Your addiction also included, you mentioned anger as a primary source of an issue in your life, but it also spilled over into chemical addiction, did it not?
Well, my first recovery was from alcohol. In alcohol addiction in AA, and then I found out I was codependent, and I moved on to codependence in CODA. And I read and studied all the books I could and everything, and over 28 years, everything just got a lot better. I didn't drink, and I wasn't so addicted to my wife, and everything was just getting better, except I was still angry. And I couldn't understand, because I had assumed that shame was the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the shame comes from childhood abuse, which caused the codependence, which caused me to drink.
Right.
And I just, I couldn't understand why healing the shame, which I obviously had, didn't heal the anger.
Anger is a tough one. I have I have a few friends in my history, one in particular that was just so angry most of the time. I remember going on a short trip with that gentleman and his family, and he couldn't get his car hooked up to the RV in front of him and became so angry he slammed the door of the car and broke the windows in it. And I still to this day don't know what was the motivation for his anger, but he was a person with what would be termed a short fuse. Would that describe you?
Yeah, that describes me. A short fuse in certain situations. Generally impatient, but my situations were mainly in relationships and with my parents, especially with women, because they seemed, some of them seemed like my mother was.
Right.
And I realized early on that shame, which was caused by the childhood abuse, was probably why I was angry. That's why I tried to cure the shame, and I thought that would cure the anger, but it didn't.
Did it affect your career choices at all?
No, I was able to manage it and not pop off when it would get me in trouble until the last time.
Until the last time. That's a very
well. I was arrested
response.
For spousal abuse. I grabbed my wife and held her and screamed in her face, and I was arrested a couple of days later, and probably properly so. I shouldn't have done that. And I went to jail for 32 hours, and was arraigned and sentenced to go to anger management classes.
And those anger management classes that you referred to, those are classes that are available to just about anyone that has an issue, correct?
Well, I think I had signed up for one, which was probably set up to handle court mandated or sentenced people. This one was set up to serve the courts, but it was really totally worthless. The problem was, they teach you in anger management how to manage it. In other words, rational ways to hold your anger in and and to not act it out so strongly.
Right.
I learned my anger in my childhood abuse before I was rational. My memories of what made me angry were body memories, cellular memories, subconscious. They weren't verbal. There were pictures and senses and sounds and smells and things like that. So the rational, all the therapy and all the anger management didn't do me any good. I needed to work on the deep emotions.
The deep emotions. You have. How long did it take you, Verrill, to write or recount your story in print with these 326 pages?
I worked on it about a year. Worked on it intensely for about 7 or 8, maybe 9 months. I mean, 7 days a week.
Intense.
8 to 12 hours a day.
What was that part of your, what I would call your recovery therapy, perhaps, from a personal standpoint?
Yeah, that was my program for me. In my writing and research, and one thing would lead to another, and one thing would lead to another, and I'd read another book, and I'd read another book, and I'd read another book, and it all came together till I got what I thought was a very coherent, logical, rational theory on how to get over my anger. My anger was not caused to shame, as I said. My anger was caused to pain. I went to after I was arrested, I went to a recovery center, and at the end of this 1 week workshop, he was doing my homework, and he was working one-on-one with everybody else watching, and he looked at me very quietly and with a somber voice, said, "A lifetime of losses and pain," and I lost it. I just cried like a baby.
Mm.
Nobody had ever called into attention that I had been in pain all my life.
Right.
So my theory that it's an addiction is that anger is an addiction because it makes you feel good, like drinking makes you feel good, because it kills the pain.
Right.
It's a way of dealing with the pain, maybe feeling powerful over old events that reoccur from childhood. Now, not all anger, but a lot of anger is. A lot of people that are angry.
Your book is more than a biographical sketch, though. You have examined the perspective of anger from where you have developed and finally gotten it under control. You have a book here that, is it only a book that will appeal to people who have those types of addictions, or do you think it has a broader necessity?
No, I don't think so. I think it will appeal, and I hope it will help people that have anger that was caused by that relates back to things that sound like and feel like childhood stuff. Mm. And they don't know it. And I didn't know it. I mean, I realized I was angry at women generally, if they sounded like my mother. I made that connection.
Yes.
And, well, my mother abused me, and so that was it. But there was a lot more to it. The abuse caused me shame, caused me losses in my childhood. I lost myself. I lost my body wasn't any good. It was beat. My emotions were any good. I was left to cry. My dad didn't do anything. I was neglected. So I was abandoned. I had all those emotions. They were losses, so serious losses to my inner self. That caused pain, and I was sad and painful about it. The way I handled it was to get angry because it made me feel powerful. The other part that I realized that it was an addiction, my anger, was that it was obviously pathological. It had a progression and signs and symptoms, and it never got better. It only got worse, and it obviously had life-damaging consequences. That's John Bradshaw's working definition of an addiction. Then when I realized I was in denial over it, it had all the hallmarks of an addiction. When I did that and started to grieve the pain, I got over the pain and the anger went away.
The grieving process, is that the beginning of your recovery, really, of your real recovery?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
So in answer to your question, I kind of got off track there. It's I only had one case study, me. I'm not a therapist. I'm a physicist.
Correct.
So my case study was me. But I backed up everything that I thought about me with dozens and dozens and dozens of books. The longest chapter is chapter 15, which I call Recovery Junkie, is the bibliography chapter in the middle of the book about the 20, 30, 40 books that I refer to. There's 76 footnotes in the book.
Amazing.
There's a glossary of terms, and it's a very serious book that's well backed up by the theory, the conventional theory. John Bradshaw, Pia Melody, Ann Wojcik, I can never pronounce her name, T.N. Dayton, many, many, many gurus of the recovery theory of all different kinds of addictions.
Again, it's a book of more than just a biographical sketch of your life. I mean, this is something that will pass along to others.
Well, I hope it'll become part of the literature of anger, and I don't have any need to sell it to make money, but I hope it'll sell 1,000 books this year to help 500 or 1,000 people, and next year 1,000, and next year 1,000, next year 1,000. My books that I love for my recovery that have helped me so much, I bought them 20 and 30 years ago. I can walk into any bookstore today and buy them. They're still for sale.
Still
solid.
I hope
that this book will become one, because there are a lot of angry people, as you mentioned.
Absolutely.
Now, you mentioned one thing about your friend. I have no idea what caused his anger, what triggered him with his car. But there are certain things. People can get angry with PTSD or something, you know, from things that they learn in adulthood that they can get shot at or see, you know, all the news, watch the news. Anything in the news can make you angry.
That's just true.
War trauma and things like that.
Yes.
Those things happen in adulthood. They're not necessarily stored as non-rational information in the subconscious. On the other hand, some PTSD may be so irrational if you're in war. Maybe that is stored. Maybe that's where PTSD comes from. I'm saying maybe because I don't know, but maybe a deep emotional thing will work with PTSD. And the things I have read about PTSD, it is deep emotional work that they find is working, getting down to the inner self.
Right. You have mentioned in your earlier conversation that tears were an integral part of your recovery, at least the beginning steps. You also have a chapter that there is other ways to grieve. What have you discovered in that grieving process that might be unique to people?
I put that in because my way of grieving, I looked at pictures of my wedding album when we got the divorce after I went to jail, of course, and cried over the loss. And each time I cried, that was grieving. But some people can't cry. And for whatever reason, they can't cry. But there are numerous ways in my recovery books I found when I looked for them to grieve. There are excellent books that I refer to in there. There's writing with your left hand to get down to your childhood memories with your offhand. There's writing letters to yourself with your left hand. There's talking to an empty chair that represents your father that beat you or your mother that abused you. There's all kinds of techniques, and I refer to them. I think it'd be a good source for people. Other ways to grieve. There's many, 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 many ways to do it.
Those are great suggestions. I can think of the one that I use, and that's banana fudge sundaes. I mean, that's probably not a good choice, but you know, those are ways I deal with stress sometimes.
Hey, whatever works, huh?
Probably so. You have a book that is very complete, 326 pages. It took a while for you to complete this, of course. Is there an underlying message besides the grieving process that you feel might come through to the reader?
Well, yeah. A real important message is anger is not necessarily bad behavior by a bad person. Don't tell yourself you're a bad person because you're angry. Maybe you're a sick person and just need to get well. And if you consider yourself an addict, most people would go, "Ooh, I don't want to be an addict."
Right.
But would you rather be a bad person? Because that may be what you've been telling yourself. So would you rather be a sick person trying to get well or a bad person trying to act better? I could never act better. For 50 years, I couldn't act better. But when I got rid of the pain, the anger went away.
That's great advice. In addition to the mechanical side of putting this book together, were there other challenges that you hadn't anticipated but had to overcome?
Well, I thought the crying would do it. I realized I had grieved, but I didn't realize it was an addiction. When I realized that my anger made me feel good, made me feel powerful, then I realized I was in denial, and that's why it took so long for me to get over it. Yeah, so for someone struggling with anger, the denial, because it feels so good. Like an alcoholic is in denial because alcohol is his best friend. That's what makes him feel good. That's what gets him through the day. Well, that anger got me through the day a lot of times. So, but of course, I knew it was a problem, but it wasn't big enough to work on it. I jived myself.
Right. Oh, Varel, this is a book that has taken a lifetime to create, and I'm wondering, is there another one on the horizon? What is your goal for this book?
Well, I'm actually working on an anger addiction program to try to provide it to the local court system as an experimental program, which I would fund with a therapist, and to replace, on an experimental basis, anger management classes to see if we couldn't reach some people who have that childhood stuff.
Boy.
And maybe we could help them. And if that helps in a circle classroom kind of group therapy kind of session, that's what the advantage of anger management is. It doesn't work very well, but at least it's cheap because, you know, for $10 or $20 times 10 people or 15 people, that can you can afford a decent therapist. But as opposed to individual $125 an hour sessions. So if I can pull that off, and my mantra is it's only grandiose if you don't pull it off. If I can pull off that grandiose idea and have an experimental program with 5 to 10 people sitting in a circle meeting once a week rather than going to anger management that are sent there by the court, then we'll really have something, and then I will really have made a contribution.
I think that's a great idea. My best wishes to you in that endeavor.
I think it'll work.
I think it would, too. I love the fact that you have been forthcoming and also transparent in what you've shared in your book. Again, the title is Recovery from Anger Addiction, subtitled How I Recovered from Rage by Resolving My Lifetime of Losses and Pain. Varel, V. Fosnight has been my guest. Varel, where do we get copies of your book?
Well, it's available as all e-books on Kindle and all the other popular e-book formats. It's as a soft cover or a hard cover on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I use Abe Books once in a while for specialized books, and I've seen it on Karen's Books and others. Yeah, I think you can get it just about any place.
And do you have a website?
Yes, I do, and it is... what is it? It's anger addiction, all one word, smeared together, .org. Angeraddiction.net, I'm sorry. Angeraddiction.net.
Angeraddiction.net. And they can do a search under your name, spelled V-E-R-R-Y-L, middle initial V, last name Fosnight, to locate this book if they can't find it from their local bookseller. Local bookseller can also order this in if they request it. And Varel, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing your story.
You're welcome. Unless they go to one of the bookstores, the recovery bookstores, that I've given it away.
Well, congratulations.
For them to sell. Okay, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Good for visiting with you. Thank you again for joining me today. For Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff. And find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today I'm honored to visit with author Linda Maria Frank, who joins me from the state of New York in the United States of America to talk about the latest in the series of Annie Tillery mysteries titled The Mystery of the Lost Avenger. Welcome, Linda, to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Jay. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Great to talk with you. This book, titled The Mystery of the Lost Avenger, is a continuation of a series of books that you have written. Would you describe your style and content as the same audience? What age would that be?
Actually, The Mystery of the Lost Avenger is number 4 in the Annie Tillery mystery series. So I like to call my books Nancy Drew meets CSI, because when I was a kid, I loved Nancy Drew. Actually, Nancy made me a lifetime reader. And then I taught forensic science, and I decided to marry the two and come up with some stories. I spent my life in the classroom with young minds who liked good stories, and that's actually how I got started writing. I used to write silly stories for them. And then that evolved into, let me see if I can write a book.
Oh, phenomenal. You as an instructor, as an educator, you have brought all of those tools into the writing field as well. You have, in writing your books, the creative process, have you always, even from a young age, been a creative?
I've been creative, but I can't say that I really love to write. I got really into writing as a part of my teaching career, because when you teach, you end up doing a lot of writing. And my creativity was to write curriculum that was interesting. I taught science, and I just thought there's such a wealth of fun things you can do in science. So I ended up writing curriculum. And along with the curriculum, I wrote stories. I made up stories for the kids. Some were true, some were silly. My favorite story is that Isaac Newton invented the Fig Newton. to make money so he could support a scientific career. So that was one of my silly stories.
I love that.
Yeah, it's a cute one.
Of course, I'm a silly guy. I'm a silly person, so I would obviously gravitate toward that. I'm not the master of puns, but I use them quite frequently. The Mystery of the Lost Avenger. Now, you also have dabbled into the historical accuracy in this novel. There are some key points that actually are based on history.
Yes. Well, this is what I try to do. I can't get the educator out of me. So all of my books have mystery, history, and science. And in The Mystery of the Lost Avenger, it's a story that takes place in two times. And my heroine, Annie Tillery, actually gets in touch with her ancestry. Her great-grandmother happened to be a WASP, which is Women's Air Service Pilots. In World War II, she worked for Grumman and tested planes. That's true. I mean, not the character of her grandmother, but actually
right.
WASPs did test planes for Grumman. Grumman Aviation was one of the major producers of planes during World War II, and the plant is right here on Long Island, so it was easy to do the research. I just went to the Cradle of Aviation Museum. In fact, my inspiration came from that. I was at the Cradle of Aviation Museum, because Long Island is the Cradle of Aviation, with my family, and they were off doing whatever they were doing, and I was wandering around, and I came across this plane. The Avenger is an airplane, and it was instrumental in winning the war in the Pacific. So in front of this plane is a plaque dedicated to the women who built it, tested it, and flew it to to California to the air bases.
Mm.
And this is one of those days that you could actually climb into the airplane. So, of course, Linda climbed into the airplane. I sat in the seat. And you know what? It's so funny because the dashboard on your 2015, 16 SUV is more complicated than the instrument panel on this plane.
Fascinating.
And I sat there, and this feeling came over me. I never really had that happen to me, and I said, I have to write a story about these women. So that was the inspiration, and it went from there. And also in the book, it talks about actual German spies that made their way to Long Island. That's true as well. Submarines actually dropped spies off. Some of them were apprehended. We actually got a lot of information from one of the spies who actually willingly decided that he needed to tell what was going on. It was probably in the middle of the war, and maybe things weren't looking so good for the Germans. I don't know. But those things are true. The rest of it is, the rest of the plot is fiction.
How did you get introduced to Annie Tillery? Where did she come from?
Annie Tillery is the teenager I would have loved to have been. She's basically a girl who's a compilation of my favorite students. I won an award for inspiring girls to go into science. So I had a lot of girl students who impressed me, and so I decided that I would create a role model for girls, and I wanted her to be attractive, not beautiful, smart but not nerdy. You know, I wanted her to be the kind of girl that today's teenagers could relate to or today's girls could relate to. She's adventurous. She's a risk taker. Then she just loves to get into some kind of a puzzle that she can solve. So her name comes from, well, I just think Annie is cute. And then I was stuck in a traffic jam on the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway, and the exit was Tillery Street.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
And I spelled it wrong.
Well,
so,
you did well.
So that's where she comes from.
Is the story and the characters totally immersed in the era of World War II?
It goes back and forth. It's set in 1943 in the Grumman plant. And it's set in the present in the ancestral home of Annie in New Windsor, Maryland, and also on Long Island in Republic Field. So it goes from the present back to 1943. It goes back and forth.
Do all of your novels with Annie Tillery do the same?
What do you mean, be the same setting?
Not the same setting, but do they also have that same time frame?
No. This is the only one that goes back and forth in time.
Excellent.
So the other novels all stay in the present.
Have you had any response to this novel yet? I mean, what has been the response?
The people who've read it as either beta readers or people who've just bought the book and read it, because the book's only been out for a month, so they love it. They absolutely love it because it's very it's kind of emotional because Annie is getting in touch with her past. She never knew about this person, and it's making her so proud that she had an ancestor who did what her great grandmother did. And at the end, she meets with four of her great grandmother's surviving friends who actually worked with her, and the end of the book is pretty emotional. It's a sweet book.
Most of my authors have a technique for laying out a story. Did you sit down and actually do an outline, or was this something that just grew organically, carried along by the characters?
No, I can't write that. What I have to do is I have to write an outline because it's a mystery. Everything has to dovetail at the end. You can't just go off on little bird walks and,
right,
and have them not show up at the end of the book. So I do an outline. I get an idea for a story. I do an outline. Then I do a chapter outline. And then I actually do a flow chart with clues. If I introduce a clue, it has to end up somewhere making sense. And so I do a flow chart of how it's going to move through the chapters, and then I also do a character outline. So I'm very organized as far as the way I write, and my writing style is what I try to do is at the end of every chapter, I try to say something, do something, introduce something that makes you want to go on to the next chapter. I also try to introduce an emotional angle In other words, it's not just a mystery story. It's not just a history story. There's an emotional angle where Annie is getting involved with either her boyfriend, Ty, her mother, her grandmother, her father. She lives with her aunt, who is a New York City police detective. So something is always going on in her life as well as the mystery.
Is there some action in here also that may attract even some male readers?
Action? Oh, yes. Well, I think the male readers will be very interested. I've actually had teachers buy a classroom set of my books, and, of course, the class is mixed boys and girls, and then they send me questions and comments, and the boys like the books just as much as the girls. But what's in this book for boys is just a lot about airplanes. Annie's boyfriend, Tyler Egan, gets his pilot's license. So they spend some time in the air, and they also spend some time talking about the features of the plane. And then, of course, there's a lot about the features of the Avenger and the history of the Avenger. Boys are usually interested in airplanes and their history and how they impacted the American scene, so to speak.
Absolutely. In a couple of sentences, explain to my listeners why they should also get a copy of this book along with your others in the series.
Well, the books are, if you liked CSI, if you like forensic science, you like solving a scientific puzzle and understanding the science behind it, all of my books include that. You also have characters who are fun. There's some humor in the book. For instance, the book before this is called Secrets in the Fairy Chimneys. And there's nothing about fairies in this. Fairy chimneys are a geological formation in Turkey. But there are two characters in the book, a boy and a girl. They're 12-year-old twins, and they try to convince Annie to use a Ouija board to channel Nancy Drew to solve the mystery. So there's a lot of humor and silliness in the book, which, you know, keeps you chuckling. So they're fun. These books are just fun. If you're an adult, and I have a lot of adult readers, actually, they will transport you back to when you were 11 or 12 years old and you were reading Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys and all those fun things. So I try to make them fun, but I also try to educate at the same time in a way that's interesting.
Linda, the title is The Mystery of the Lost Avenger. Who is the Lost Avenger and how did that title come about?
Okay, the Avenger is a Grumman plane that was actually used in World War II, and it was significant in winning the war in the Pacific. And what happens in the book is the wreckage of an Avenger is found in the Appalachian Mountains. Grumman knew it was missing. They didn't know what happened to it, but it was found by some prospectors for mining in the mountains of Appalachia. And then, of course, once it was discovered, the NCIS, because it's a Navy plane, investigated and found a note in it from Annie Tillery's grandmother, great-grandmother, and that's how she found out about the plane crash, and the story goes from there.
Beautiful story. The title, again, is The Mystery of the Lost Avenger, an Annie Tillery mystery. My author, Linda Maria Frank. Linda, where can my listeners get copies of your book?
You can get copies on the Archway website, and you also can get them in Amazon. And if you go on my website, which is lindamariafrank.com, that's the easiest way to get to get a copy of the book.
Have you been inspired to continue with an additional mystery in the near future?
Well, what's happened with this is that Annie and her boyfriend are going off to college, and they're just about, you know, they're young adults now. And I'm thinking that I may decide the next book is going to be an adult mystery.
Interesting.
Same characters, because they keep growing up. I can't keep them. I can't trap them at the age of 18 or 19.
It's hard to do that, absolutely. I've got a grandson who just turned 18, so I can relate. The title of this book, again, is The Mystery of the Lost Avenger. Listeners, if you want to get a copy of this and your local bookseller does not have it, they can order it in by request. Again, the author, Linda Maria Frank. Thank you, Linda, for joining me today.
And thank you, Jay.
My pleasure. For Indie Book Publishing Archway Press, this is Jay Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Silent Thought, America in Crisis. And the author is Charlie Wirz, and Charlie joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Charlie.
Hello, how are you today?
Great to have you with us. America in Crisis. I think most people would see America's having big problems, and you're proposing that we as Americans, we're the ones to step forward and just not just think about it, but to do something. But, you know, a lot of people don't know quite what to do with their thoughts, do they? Or they forget them and they don't pay attention even to themselves, the importance of their thoughts.
That's very true. The opening segments of the book, the first couple of chapters, deal with just that. For example, the first chapter deals with spontaneous thought, and second chapter is more regarding targeted thought. And this is not to be overly technical writing. It's more to provoke and get a discussion going with my readers about what thought is all about as it relates to everyday experiences, and whether or not we act on those thoughts or feel they're necessary to act on, and how they come into our consciousness.
How would you say the media controls our thinking?
Well, I think to a great deal, if we're one that simply relies on quick sound bites and absorbs those without any critical thought analysis, we become very susceptible to what the media has to say. And then it's a question of the choices we make in terms of which media, whether it be print or electronic media, whether it's the internet or whether it's the news media itself via cable and broadcast channels.
So when we talk about silent thought, one phrase comes to my mind very quickly, the silent majority, and I guess that is really the same thing, isn't it?
Yes, I believe it's so. I mean, I think that we have gotten ourselves into a mindset as Americans that we leave the critical decisions, the important decisions, to a small few, primarily, and the book is more tailored to what is occurring in Washington, D.C., as it relates to our national politicians. So we leave those thinking that it's going to be just fine with a small few, instead of remembering that it's up to every American to be part of that process in different ways, of course.
Now, you've already mentioned spontaneous thought. That's your first chapter. Your second chapter is targeted thought. Let's talk a little bit about what you mean by spontaneous versus targeted. Let's start with spontaneous.
Well, I think what I mean by spontaneous is that we sit, and I give some examples. We might be sitting in a coffee shop, for example, and we're just sitting there. We might be reading, we might be writing, and we're really interacting with all of those triggers that hit our consciousness, as well as we might see other people, hear other conversations, overhear other conversations. So throughout our day, even through our work day, we are exposed to a lot of thought triggers that create spontaneous thought. And that's just what it is. And that sometimes is very fleeting. We sometimes try to, I mentioned in the book that sometimes we have a thought and then we think to ourselves, wow, that was this is powerful, this means a lot, and then before you know it, it's no longer resides in our consciousness, and we wonder, what was that thought? And I know right. It was good, but I just can't remember exactly what it was.
Boy, if I don't write it down, it's gone. I know that.
Right.
So then targeted thought.
Well, targeted thought is what I try to relate this to as I move through the book and then take this concept or take this concern and talk about what I believe are the five major crises facing our country. I look at targeted thought and try to connect that to how this affects these crises. And targeted thought, in my mind, is really through the either direct or indirect actions of others. You mentioned the media, for example. I believe the media is very much involved in targeting our thought. Now, one of the things I mentioned is, for example, advertisement, which is not a big problem, but so you don't have a problem necessarily, the people that are trying to sell a product or a service, they are targeting your thought. So if you pick up a newspaper and you see advertisements, that's usually what's happening there. But if you pick up a newspaper and you're, for example, reading an article that is biased in some way, well, the reality behind that is it's actually trying to target your thought and for a particular purpose, whether it's whatever bias it might have or whatever it's trying to accomplish. So the whole idea is to be able to understand what the target of thought is, that meaning what is someone trying to accomplish by that, or if you're within a group of people or you're listening to someone on a TV program, which is supposedly a news program, but yet you're hearing things that are trying to target you in a way to get you to absorb it and not only agree to it. So that's a lot of what the targeted thought chapter is about.
And today, at this moment in time, with this upcoming presidential election, a lot of efforts to target our thoughts, to convince us one way or another. And so you're saying there's never been a more critical time for us to re-examine our thinking, our thoughts.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And one of the reasons being that we are in a presidential election year. And I really believe America is at a crossroads in a lot of different ways. And that's the reason behind identifying what I believe are major crises in this country. So it's okay for a politician, for example, to target a thought. We want them to tell us what they believe, what they stand for. But we also want to, we should believe in the fact that we do have the discipline and a lot of time to understand whether or not that targeted thought is valid, and our, you know, what we're listening to has merit or doesn't have merit. But there's no question that, and again, you're also targeted in a highly charged political year such as this one by people who support a particular candidate. And let's just talk about the presidency. So you have people on both sides of that trying to target your thought and get you to believe a certain way in order to secure your vote.
Your book focuses on, as you've already pointed out, five crises in America. Let's just talk a couple of those, all the time we have, just to focus in on a couple. American crisis number one, it's chapter three, leadership in America. Share some things with us.
Well, again, I think everyone should set their expectations very high when it comes to our leaders. But one of the things I try to get into in this chapter is, how do we choose our leaders? And, you know, through life, through childhood, through adulthood, we hopefully have people that we have identified as leaders. And that can change many times, but we want to be sure that and leadership has qualities that should be, as I said, a very high threshold. And for example, the things I talk about in this chapter are, I start with one of the most important positions in our country, and that is our president. And why leadership is so critical to that individual's ability to either enhance America or diminish America. And leadership, and it, the book is tries to be very fair in assessing our current president's behavior as a leader. And I think in some ways it's been not very good. And I try to identify that, and but in trying to get America to believe we should be a nation of leaders and not believe or entrust it into a small group of people, especially those few number of politicians in Washington, D.C.
I think it's so important, at least from my experience, that we as citizens must learn that we can really make a difference. Our thinking is important, our views, our opinions, but we have to gain that confidence to share them, and often to share them in the public arena in front of others, and that's quite challenging for many.
Well, without a doubt, and I think that it does have a lot to do with confidence and conviction. I think that most Americans are leaders in a lot of ways, whether it be family or workplace. But as a country, we can't keep just allowing the so-called leadership through our political process to entrust that's going to happen the right way. Every American has a role to play, some more than others. But first and foremost, and that's why the book started with thought, because you have to first have that thought and that critical analysis and take that time rather than accepting everything as is. You know, and then I talk in the leadership into this chapter about what I believe the critical traits are for a successful leader.
Well, let's talk a little bit about chapter 4. That's American Crisis Number 2, Political Correctness. Boy, we hear that PC term all the time.
Right. Exactly. And it may not sound like a crisis, but it certainly is. And I think that the what's creeping into our country is, again, this has to do with thought. In my mind, political correctness is nothing more than a narrow viewpoint by very few people trying to control the thought and speech of others. And I think if the thought process is not critical, not only, as you said, without confidence, you won't really find a way to express it or think you need to express it, and you'd rather simply conform to what a political correctness, you know, mindset might have you conform to. My we're keeping it very simple, is my litmus test on this is, I think of it in terms of American correctness and what has made this country great. I don't think we should be overly focused on this. And again, this is a term that's developed. This whole political correctness is a very narrow viewpoint in my mind in this country.
I know I have learned a lot by studying the founders of our country and the whole process they went through, and it really inspires anyone who will look into history, because history will repeat itself for good or bad.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think that, just speaking of leadership, I think that we don't, and even as everyday Americans, we don't take enough thought and consideration of all the historical value that we have as a country, and continue to build on that and learn from that.
You also cover, I'm just going to read the other crises that you mention. You have American Crisis Number 3, which is race relations in America, American Crisis Number 4, politics in America, and American Crisis Number 5, open borders and immigration. Obviously, all these we hear in the news all the time, and they're very critical issues that have to be not only thought about, but take action upon to make America better, because we as citizens, as you point out, we're so distracted. It's hard to focus, isn't it?
Oh, without a doubt. It's more of a distracted citizenry than it has ever been before. And some of that is because we just don't take the time, and we'd rather preoccupy ourselves with the more, you know, more enjoyable aspects of life. Politics in general, and I think that in itself is probably why it's one of the most important chapters, is because it really takes a look at how politics affect every aspect of our life. And I think that a lot of Americans don't really believe that. You think of it in the abstract and sort of put it off to the side. Think it'll take care of itself.
Again, the title of the book, The Silent Thought, America in Crisis, and we've been talking to the author, Charlie Wirz. Charlie, what's the best way to get your book?
Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or ArchwayPublishing.com.
Thank you so much, Charlie, so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And this interview has been brought to you by Archway Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.